Well, good afternoon, Juneau. It's 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Pat Moore. I'm your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and I have a great lineup of guests coming. Mike Christensen and Eric Caldwell are standing by right now to bring us information on the Poetic License event coming up Friday night. We'll have Elfrida Nord in to tell us about the Scandinavian Dance Saturday at the Yacht Club. Mary Doria Russell will be here. She's giving a presentation, giving a library presentation this evening. And Vince Welch, author of The Last Voyager, the story of Amos Berg, former Junoite in the Rivers of the West, will be appearing at Hearthside Books, State Historical Library, and the library, the community library, and we'll contact Vince by telephone and get some details on his appearances here. And Christina Butcher will drop in to tell us about GeoFest coming up. The weather, well, you're looking at it, and it looks like it's going to cloud up. We'll have a slight chance of snow late tonight. Lows around 27, east winds about 5 miles per hour, and then Saturday cloudy, chance of snow in the morning, becoming rain in the afternoon, rain through the weekend, including Monday for Veterans Day. So there you go. That's the weather.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Less than 2 months into a six-month wolf hunting season, Wisconsin hunters have already surpassed half of their quota. That could mean the wolf hunt will end in some zones as early as December. Mike Simonson reports.
DNR Lands Administrator Kurt Thede says with 59 wolves killed and a quota of 116, this is a faster pace than in other states that have been hunting wolves for years.
The fact that we have reached this halfway point and we've done so safely is that our hunters and trappers are successful in helping us manage the population.
Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission biologist Peter David says he's not surprised so many wolves have been taken so fast.
I know a lot of people believe that there might be some real problems harvesting wolves in the state, but two things I think came into play here. One is the state issued a relatively high number of permits, 10 for each animal that they wanted harvested. And then I think the second part of it is that Wisconsin wolves are really accessible.
So David says this is proof the six-month season is too long and that dogs aren't needed to hunt wolves.
That provision has been put on hold for this year because of the lawsuit brought by the Humane Society. And I think regardless of how you might feel about that suit, I think it is pretty clear that there is really no need to have that methodology, a very controversial method in order to reach the quotas.
Thede says they're learning what works and what's needed. One is that 64% of the wolves harvested have been taken by trappers.
This is our first year. It's always hard to kind of develop a trend or make any conclusions from one season. So we'll learn a lot from this first year as far as what techniques are most effective.
Most of the wolves have been trapped or shot in the two northern zones from Douglas to Marinette counties. Once a zone's quota has been reached, wolf hunting will end there. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, Jacqueline Johnson-Peta, says there are still some key Indian country issues going before Congress. Peta recently discussed a few of them with attendees at the Alaska Federation of Natives Annual Convention in Anchorage. Mike Mason has more.
Congress is scheduled to take up a number of critical issues when they go back into session in mid-November. Johnson-Peta says budget sequestration will be issue number one.
And so we have our message, hold harmless Indian country budget. And it's going to be challenging in this environment, and you have to be engaged.
The impending sequestration basically calls for automatic budget cuts totaling about $1 trillion over the next 10 years, with about $109 billion in cuts each year. The automatic cuts go into effect January the 2nd unless a deal is worked out between Congress and the administration of President Barack Obama. Johnson-Peta says there are other items on the agenda for the lame duck Congress, including the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act.
We believe that we have an opportunity to be able to pull the Republicans and the Democrats together, the House and the Senate together, to be able to merge the two versions of the bill in conference and to be able to get the Violence Against Women Act addressed.
The current reauthorization effort is stalled in Congress for a number of reasons, including efforts to extend protections to gays and lesbians, as well as Native Americans. The National Congress of American Indians is also supporting the effort put forward by outgoing Hawaii Senator Daniel Akaka, calling for the restoration of tribal lands.
Restoration of tribal lands means that we want to do the carcerary fix. We have a provision that's been introduced in the House version of the bill by Congressman Cole on behalf of Congressman Young to be able to make sure that we can't precludes the effort for us to be able to bring land into the trust for Alaska. Another issue where we have to resolve the differences between the Senate version and the House version to see if we can get this important bill that actually means so much to tribes across the country and clarifies, legally clarifies, the ability of the Secretary of Department of Interior to take land into trust in behalf of tribes.
The lame duck session of Congress is scheduled to begin November 13th. I'm Mike Mason.
During this week in 2009, President Obama and his cabinet held a historic meeting with tribal leaders in Washington, D.C. to address issues facing their communities. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5:06 after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. I have a couple of guys in the room who are ready to improvise and at the drop of a hat. Mike Christensen and Eric Caldwell are here. They're doing an interesting show called a Poetic License event tonight at the Canvas, right?
At the Canvas, yes.
So what is this?
What it is, we have a very strong and vibrant slam poetry community. We also have a solid improv community here, and we decided that we wanted to let the two of them mingle. Some of the poets are already doing improvised slam poetry, and so we wanted to give an opportunity for some of the other poets who might want to give it a try and learn what it's about to train in improvised poetry and give the improvisers a chance to be poetic as well.
Mike, for those who haven't attended one of these things, what's a slam?
A slam is a poetry competition, usually about eight competitors, five judges in the audience. They will do a poem. The judges will throw up scores, and the highest and lowest will be thrown out, and it goes on until the final person with the most points wins.
So the poems that are slammed, is that the right verb? The poems that are presented or whatever or voiced, are they pieces that people write before? I understand tonight is improv, but at a normal slam, are they pieces that people write and then bring in to recite, or do they make them up on the spot, or how's that work?
I have to write mine down, but Kate has been known to do spontaneous poetry.
And Kate will be
the instructor tonight.
This is Kate Laster, and she's going to do some instructing tonight.
Yep.
How's that work?
So Kate's going to be leading a workshop at 6 o'clock. She's going to be working with people on finding their poetic voice and displaying it in real time with, well, her word is chutzpah, you know, coming out there with just with verve, knowing that whatever you say, it's going to be the right thing to say. It doesn't matter if the rhyme's off, if the meter's off, if you just go out there, push it out there and sell it, then you're going to have a poem that other people believe in just as much as you wish you did.
Okay, now for poetry, you just defined exactly the same thing that an improv player has to do.
Yes.
Because you've got to believe in what you're going to say, and when I sell you the idea, you got to buy it.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why these two are like merging together, because this event is being put together by Morally Impoverished.
Yes, it is.
Right, and the slam is the other group. So you guys are kind of melding your.
We've certainly been in contact with them and let them know, hey, you know, send your people to us, because one of their own is teaching it. You know, Kate is very active in the slam, so she's teaching it. We want to bring the slam people into our community through her and through Mike, who also is heavily active in their community, and just see what happens when we cross media and bring the two together.
Mike, where's this idea of poetry slams coming from?
1984 in Chicago, I guess. But it sprang up, I think, spontaneously in several parts of the country. I know we were doing it in Madison back in the day, and it was a reaction against people sitting down and listening very quietly as someone recited a sonnet that was in a particular form, and then there was a light smattering of applause at the end, and then we went over and had a little bit of tea and crumpets. You know, it was a reaction against academic bloodless poetry to bring it to life, basically.
So, part of the idea is: does the poem have to contain a shocking element in order to be a success here? Is that what the judges are looking for?
I think that you can never tell what the judges are looking for, because if you could, then I would have won every slam. But sometimes they're looking for humor. Sometimes they're looking for psychological honesty. And sometimes there is an element of shock value.
And Juno being Juno, you're going to have a fairly wide range of judges and a fairly wide range of experiences. You're not presenting your slam poetry to a panel of five PhDs.
And I can tell you at the last one, they were not looking for political poems. That's
so,
found that out a little bit too late.
Too late? Okay. This is the voice of experience.
So there's a interesting break in standards that... It's going to depend on the individuals who are judging any single event.
Okay, but this is not a judged event tonight. This is an exhibition,
right?
Tonight
is not a judged event, no. We're going to have a workshop for people who are interested in learning some techniques at 6 o'clock. And at 8 o'clock, we're going to have an exhibition for anyone who wants to try improvised slam poetry in front of an audience. And also, you know, inviting that audience to come to us. People who just want to come and watch and see what people come up with and be supportive of the people who are getting up there and giving it a try. We would love to see a lot of you out there at 8 o'clock as well.
What would be a comfortable number? I'm just curious. When you come out there and you look out when you peek through the curtains, how many would you like to see out in the seats?
Well, that
I
room
know there's
there,
no curtains,
yeah,
right.
the gallery will hold about 40 to 50 people.
Okay.
So
you'd feel real good if you had 40 to 50 people.
I would feel exceptional if we had 40 to 50
so then
people
the second
for
question
an
is,
exhibition.
Who would you like them to be?
Oh.
Who do you wish would be out there?
I would like to see a cross-section of the community. When we have done the project so far, we've had a mixture of people who have been involved in improv and people who have... just said, you know,
writers
I saw this.
And actors and...
Well, and people who just said, I saw this on the KTOO events page, or I saw the poster, and I've never done anything like this, and I thought I'd give it a try, because it sounded fun. So we've seen people from zero experience to, wow, you've been doing this a long time. And all of them have been welcome.
Well, times and places and all that sort of stuff. The instruction is at 6 o'clock, and that's with Kate Laster. And mm-hmm. then at 8 o'clock is the exhibition. The whole thing happens at the Canvas.
At the Canvas at Reach.
At Reach, okay. And this is on Seward Street.
Yes, you know, just in between 2nd and 3rd.
Okay. And the event is free, but you're asking for a donation for the Reach if people were willing to give it, right?
Yes, it is a free donation. The Canvas at Reach does have a donation box out for people who are feeling generous, which is hopefully everybody.
Okay. And then I just noticed here I had a note. There's another thing coming up that you wanted to talk briefly about, the Alaska State Improv Festival.
Yes, the Alaska State Improv Festival, which we have online at www.asifest.com. The Alaska State Improv Festival is the first national grade festival of its kind in Juneau. We have improvisers.
Alaska.
Well, in the whole state, that's true.
Yeah.
We have improvisers coming in from Los Angeles, Seattle, Chicago, New York, Boston, and Austin, Texas, as well as our friend Scared Scriptless up in Anchorage. They're all going to be flying into Juneau for 3 days of improv the week after the Alaska Folk Festival.
April 18th through the 20th.
Yes.
Where's your venue?
We're going to be in McPheeters Hall.
Oh,
so
okay.
very classy theater venue for our visiting guests. It'll be the first time that improv is done up there at McPheeters.
They do have a curtain that you can peek out from behind, so that's going to be a step up for us.
A big advantage. Well, you can put your hands in front of your face tonight and kind of peek through your fingers and see who's out there. Okay, I wish you great success with the event. I hope you have a full house and that everyone who comes along enjoys the heck out of this thing.
Thank you very much.
Poetry Poetic License tonight, 6 o'clock instruction, 8 o'clock the exhibition, all at the Canvas at Reach. Goodwill donation to Canvas if you want to come. Drop in.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 9th of November, 2012. It's the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night in 1938 when German Nazis coordinated a nationwide attack on Jewish homes and businesses and synagogues. More than 1,000 synagogues were burned or destroyed, about 7,500 Jewish businesses looted, Jewish hospitals, homes, schools, cemeteries vandalized. Before that night, the Nazis had killed people secretly and individually, and after Kristallnacht, the Nazis felt free to persecute the Jews openly because they knew that nobody would stop them. It's the birthday of the poet Anne Sexton, born Newton, Massachusetts, 1928. She said of her childhood, "I was locked in my room until the age of 5. After that, at home or away from it, people seemed out of reach." She never went to college. She eloped when she was 19, became a housewife, had a nervous breakdown at the age of 28, tried to commit suicide, and her psychiatrist advised her to try writing poetry as therapy. She did, and the next year she took a poetry seminar with the poet Robert Lowell, who admired her work. And within a few years of having written her first poems, she had published in more than 40 magazines, The New Yorker, Harper's, and many others. For the rest of her life, Anne Sexton was in and out of mental hospitals, on and off psychiatric drugs. She said poetry was what kept her alive. She said, "My fans think I got well, but I didn't. I just became a poet." Her collection, Live or Die, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1966. She committed suicide in 1974. And it's the birthday of the astronomer Carl Sagan, Brooklyn, 1934, professor of astronomy at Cornell University, who at a time when most other astronomers were focusing on distant stars and other galaxies, Sagan focused his research on our own solar system. It was Carl Sagan who persuaded NASA to send the Viking and Voyager and Galileo planetary missions with cameras aboard to get close-up photographs of the outer planets and their moons. He was popular on television, appeared many times on Johnny Carson, and created the TV show Cosmos, the most popular scientific television program ever produced. Here's a poem for today by Thomas R. Smith, entitled Ode to the Vinyl Record. The needle lowers into the groove, and I'm home. It could be any record I've lived with and loved a long time, Springsteen or Rodrigo, Ray Charles or Emmylou Harris. Not only the music, but the whirlpool shimmering on the turntable, funneling blackly down into the ocean of the ear. Even the background pops and hisses, a worn record wraps the music in. Creaturely imperfections, so hospitable to our own. Since those first Beatles and Stones LPs plopped down spindles on record players, we opened like tiny suitcases at sweaty junior high parties while parents were out. How many nights I've pulled around my desires a vinyl record's cloak of flaws and found it a perfect fit. The crackling unclarity and turbulence of the country's lo-fi basement heart, madly spinning, making its big, dark sound. Ode to the Vinyl Record by Thomas R. Smith. from The Foot of the Rainbow, published by Red Dragonfly Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Be a lot more of that kind of music. We're listening to Dale Weigand, and with me in the studio is Elfrida Nord, who's here to tell us about a Scandinavian dance that is coming up this weekend. Hi, Elfrida.
Hi.
So, what's going on?
Well, there is a Scandinavian dance coming up tomorrow night at the Juno Yacht Club, and it starts at 6:30, and we will have excellent live music, and we will have refreshments that people can enjoy. There is a $10 charge to come in, but or less for children. But all the refreshments are free, and we will try to have things that are sort of Scandinavian.
Elfrida, there's instruction, I think, involved with
yes,
this as
well,
yes,
there will
be right?
some instruction.
Is the dancing difficult?
Well, I don't consider it difficult, but I've been doing it for years.
Uh-huh.
It is not difficult. The steps are not difficult. It is pretty much all the Scandinavian dances are partner dances.
Okay.
So it requires teamwork.
And a polka, I think, is sort of basic to the Scandinavian dance.
Yes, polka,
right?
Schottische, and waltz are the basics. And then we have pulse and hambo and others that people enjoy. But the footwork, I mean, the music has good timing, and Dale and Beth and Steve Tata are excellent musicians who love to play for us.
You do this periodically. The dances are held about how often?
We try to have a dance once a year. That's all we have been able to muster.
Oh, okay.
If we could get a larger group of people who are interested in Scandinavian, we would do more Scandinavian. Bruce Botello has agreed that in the Juno International Dancers, if we get a larger cadre of Scandinavian and we have an equal number of people, women and men, that he will do more Scandinavian.
Oh, okay. So there may be the opportunity to do more.
There may be the opportunity to do more if people show up and learn.
This is this event is sponsored by the Sons of Norway. How big is that organization?
We have about 100 members.
Okay, and you have events that go on throughout the year. You were telling me beforehand that there's a cooking event coming up.
Yes, we in December, the second Saturday in December, we will be making lefse, potato lefse, and meatballs for the Christmas party, which will be later on in the month. And it's open to the public to come and learn how to make lefse if you're interested. It's not members only. We always encourage people to come, whether they are members or not.
Okay. And if someone came, would they need to bring anything with them? Or
no,
do you
just bring enthusiasm.
And a pencil to write the recipe down, I imagine, yeah. So what is lefse?
Lefse is, how can I explain it? Some people have described it as a Norwegian tortilla.
Oh, okay.
It's a rolled out, soft, round. It's made out of potatoes and flour mainly, and then you put butter, sugar on it, and eat it much mild, like dessert. You can eat it as a bread alongside of a meal without the sugar.
I'm starting to get hungry. And that with a plate of meatballs, I think I might be in heaven.
Well, come on the second Saturday.
What'll be on the snack tray on at the dance?
It's whatever the members bring.
Uh-huh. What's typical?
So I'm going to bring kromkaka.
You'll have to tell us what that is.
Okay, well, krumkaka is a cone-shaped pastry that's made in a special iron, and you roll it on a cone, and it gets hard, and then you fill it with cream and some jelly.
Oh, this sounds wonderful. I may have to come to this dance. So the dance is Saturday. It's at the Yacht Club.
It's at the Yacht Club.
There's a $10 admission fee, right. And instruction at the beginning, and then...
We'll have instruction from 7:30 to 8:30.
7:30 to 8:30 for instruction, right. And the actual dance runs from 8:30.
Yep, and then we will dance for... Wait, we will probably dance before and after the instruction.
Oh, I see. Okay, so some dancing and then stop once people start to trickle in the door and like that, do some instruction, get everybody onto the floor, and then and then dance until the wee hours, right?
Right. Well, at least until 9:30.
Sounds like a great event, and it sounds like the food may be worth the price of admission. Thank you so much. Let's listen a little more to Dale's music, shall
okay.
we? This is
thank
what they'll be dancing
thank to. Thank you for having us.
It's 27 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News, and you'll be hearing more of Dale Wigand's music if you go to the Scandinavian Dance. It's Saturday at the Yacht Club, starting at 6:30 with dancing. 7:30, they'll have some instruction. 8:30, they'll go back to dancing, and the party will go on until 9:30 or 10. And a wonderful-sounding sideboard of excellent things to eat. Sons of Norway are putting the event on. My next guest is here to do a presentation and book signing at the library. She'll be there on Saturday night. Mary Doria Russell has written a number of books, began, I think, with two books called The Sparrow, and then was probably pressured by the editors into writing a sequel, or maybe that one was just in your head from the beginning.
No, at that point I was still being turned down. I had 23 chapters of a sequel to a book nobody wanted to publish. So, you know, that was... there was no encouragement from a publisher at that point, although they were very happy once... Once Random House took me on, they were happy to know that I was going on with it.
If people haven't read these two books, Sparrow and Children of God are about a Jesuit priest who goes to another planet.
Jesuits in space, basically.
And,
but it's really, really classy science fiction.
Yeah, well, and there are a number of people who tried to figure out how it should be classified, because it really has an intense moral message as well, and argues a great deal about what is good and what is bad, and
what's
and
a life worth living, what's a life pissed away.
What's
worth living for, what's worth dying for,
So what was going on when you started writing this down?
Oh, my. Well, it was the 500th anniversary of Columbus landing in the New World.
Okay.
When when I started this. And
1996.
1992.
Yeah. 1992.
The Ocean Blue.
Yeah.
1400.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, there was a whole bunch of historical revisionism that was going on. Like Columbus had left Spain saying, come on, let's go depopulate a couple of continents.
Yeah.
And then we can invite over a bunch of immigrants and we'll make cars.
Yeah.
You know, it was like he screwed up the New World on purpose. The guy thought he was going to Japan, and
got lost on the way. India, actually, I think.
India. He thought he was in the Indies, and so it's not like he made a mess of things on purpose. What I wanted to do with the Sparrow was to put modern, intelligent, well-meaning, well-educated people into the same position of radical ignorance, and let's just see how well we'd do. So the only way I could do that would be to take it off planet, because there's simply no place left on Earth where we can be that ignorant, where we can meet people and not have the slightest idea how or why we are different from them. And that's what Columbus and his men faced. Now, I'm not saying they did a good job of it, but they were not very well equipped for the position that they found themselves in. And so I was trying to put the best face on it. Let's send a crew of the best people I can imagine being faced with this unprecedented first contact, and let's just play it out and see how well we do.
So the two books appear, the Sparrow appears, and it starts around, and it almost goes viral. And all of a sudden you've created another Dune, almost, not quite that crazy, but a tremendous number of people read this thing and started saying that it was part of a life philosophy.
Yes, oddly enough. It's very strange.
Were you surprised?
To this day, oh, God, yes. I expected, the outer limits of what I expected for that book was that it would get a boutique publisher, not Random House. It would get a total print run of 4,000 copies, if I was lucky. Half of them would be returned, and then I would end up with like a cult following of three neighbors and a cousin.
Uh-huh.
Really, that's, you know, and then, oh, but on the other side of my head, I'm thinking, and when they make the movie, you know, because that's the kind of, you know, mood swings that happen when you're doing something as huge as writing a novel. You know, the possibility of ever being finished at all, let alone published and doing well, noticed, getting any kind of reviews, any kind of reaction at all. It's just so hard what you're doing. I really did not anticipate that it would still be in print. You know, this is 15 years since it came out. More than that. And I wrote it in 1992. Who'd have thunk it? You know, certainly not me. I am astonished at the reach and the longevity.
So, Children of God is your second book.
That was the sequel.
And this is the sequel to that one.
Yeah.
When you had it done and you were looking back on the two books together, did you feel like you'd closed the chapter?
I did. One of the things that was good about not being able to find a publisher for the first book right away was that I had 18 months of completely depressing rejection over and over and over again. But while I was writing the sequel...
What a nice thing for an author to...
31 people thought this was a really bad idea. Jesuits in Space is not going to fly.
Yeah.
It gave me an opportunity to put the two books side by side and to make them seamlessly flow one into the other. If I had had an immediate response, oh, this is brilliant, we're going to publish it, then as I was writing the sequel, I would have been much more hampered in how I was able to develop those two books together so that they make a coherent pair. So it was actually, in retrospect, a good thing, although at the time, it felt like death every week. You know, I was drinking gravy to keep my weight in double digits. You know, really just not a good time in my life. But in retrospect, it was the best thing that could have happened.
Yep. So now you're working in a different, you know, that's like future history, and
yeah.
Now you've stepped to a different area. Although
yeah.
I think you were really writing historical fiction and moving it off planet so
yes.
that you could say what you
yeah,
wanted to
absolutely.
Say.
Yeah, you're the first one who's ever said that. But I thought of The Sparrow as historical fiction that takes place in the future.
Yeah.
The narration on that always seemed to me the voice of the narrator. The narrator is not a named character or anything, but the narration is sort of by what I thought of was a Jesuit historian looking back on what happened during first contact with maybe 100, maybe 150 years mm-hmm. between this narrator and what happened. So he has had an opportunity to study all of the memoirs and all of the data that's come back from these people and put it together. And I think the most important line in the whole book, in both of them really, is that on that first page of The Sparrow where he talks about, you know, this happened and they went to this other planet, and then there's a line that says they meant no harm.
Mm.
This doesn't mean that they didn't do harm. It doesn't mean that they didn't come to grief. But they didn't mean to make mistakes. It's inherently tragic.
So now you've moved through two other books into a real open attempt, or not attempt, but a real open project of historical fiction to
yes.
tell the story of Doc.
Yeah, Doc, and there's two in between there, too. There are
yeah,
two 20th century historicals. A Thread of Grace is about the...
And Dreamers of the Day.
Yeah. A Thread of Grace I'll be talking about tomorrow night, the actual history behind that, because that was 7 years of research based on, you know, these elderly people were giving me their most harrowing memories of what it was like to be in Italy during the Nazi occupation.
And this was the Jewish, focused particularly on the Jewish
survival,
community
yeah,
that
right.
fled to Italy.
But also
thinking,
I talked to Italians who were not, you know, directly involved with this, who were just trying to get through an occupation the best they could.
Mm-hmm.
And Germans who had memories of that as well. And so that was a 7-year effort to really show a portion of that huge time in history that I felt cast a slanted light on what is generally known about the Holocaust and about
mm-hmm.
the process of occupation. And then Dreamers of the Day goes back a little further, because everybody tells you, when you look at World War II, it's just the continuation of World War I.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a generation, there were 15, 20 years went by when we had to stop and let women have more babies that could be then grown up and made into soldiers and go on back into the war. And it was really just a moment in time where they were getting ready to finish it. So I wanted to go back and see the roots of World War II by studying World War I and then the Versailles Peace Treaty and the conferences that came out of that. That one got its start when, when Osama bin Laden took credit for the attacks on 9/11 by saying that they were in part retribution, vengeance, for the catastrophe of 80 years ago. Now, I heard that, and I thought, oh, what happened 80 years ago? World War I ended in 1918. That's not 80. The Versailles Peace Treaty, that's 1919. That's not 80 years ago either. I'm thinking to myself, is he rounding? Is it, you know, 80 years? And so I happened to be watching the History Channel on television, because I watch way too much TV. And it was the biography of Lawrence of Arabia. And I'm 62. I saw Lawrence of Arabia when it first came out, you know, with the movie. And it made a huge impact on me, as it did on many people of my generation. And I thought, I should go upstairs and get one of the biographies done. I read everything about Lawrence that was available in 1962 to about 1967. It occurred to me that I was 10 years older than Lawrence ever got to be. He died at 46. I went, oh, my God, I'm older than Lawrence of Arabia. How did that happen? I wanted to go back to the biographies and reread one or two of them and see if I reacted to him with the kind of awe and hero worship. You know, how have I changed? How does my view of a man like that change over these years? And what I found was I actually came away with even more respect and admiration for him. But most people stop with World War I. 1921,
He was a member of the 1921 Cairo Peace Conference. Do the math. That's the catastrophe of 80 years ago. That is 80 years prior to the attacks on 9/11. And so I suddenly realized that that was, in 11 days, a handful of British diplomats and oilmen invented the modern Middle East. It's their world. We just live in it. And that's what Dreamers of the Day is about, how those 11 days have affected everything that's come since then.
Mary, we're going to have to let you tell folks what Doc is about at the library.
Okay.
You're talking
Saturday
night. yeah. The Saturday night, 7 o'clock at the downtown public library. Mary Doria Russell, you heard the energy this woman generates when she starts talking. So I would say you got to do this Saturday night. It's going to be amazing. Thank
Come on
you
down.
For coming down. Yeah. About 18 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest comes to us by way of the telephone, and he has written an incredible book called The Last Voyager, the story of Amos Berg, a former Juneauite here in town, who grew up here in town or spent part of his life here. Vince Welch is on with me. Hi, Vince.
Hi, how you doing, Pat?
Pretty good. You got quite a book here.
I think so, yes.
The Last Voyager tells the story of this guy who basically was... able because of the timing to be one of the last men who ever went down all of the rivers of the West before they were dammed.
Yeah, I think timing and kind of an insatiable curiosity, and he was able to go on these rivers and had the wherewithal to stick with it. So it was a pretty amazing run there that he had in the 1920s.
It's interesting that you mentioned the word wherewithal, because he didn't use very much wherewithal to do this.
Yeah, he this is not the age of high-tech gear and somebody coming and rescuing you and boats. He was put his packages together, and he was methodical in his planning. And but like I say, he had wool clothing, and he was eating pretty sparsely. And so it's not you have to take an imaginative leap to appreciate what he had done.
Every once in a while, as you're going along in the book, you do a wonderful description that kind of awakens the reader to an awareness of what it was this guy was facing. I have a copy of your book open in front of me, and I wondered if you would let me read something from page 78.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
In the native language, Gwich'in, Yukon means great river. It is the longest river in Alaska, the third longest in North America. The debate over the source of the Yukon and the correct measuring stick, length, volume, geographic location, highest elevation, continues to this day. In any event, somewhere in the high glacier country of southeast Alaska's coastal range, 15 or so miles inland from the tidal water of Lynn Canal, the headwaters of the Yukon begin, pools to riffles to numerous creeks, until the nascent river reaches the Southern Lakes region that straddles British Columbia and the Yukon Territory. The main glacier-fed lakes, Linderman, Atlin, Bennett, Tagish, and Marsh, are relatively narrow bodies of water, flanked by snow-covered mountain ranges and low-lying forested hills, connected by equally narrow but considerably shorter arms of water. Swamps and lowlands border the lakes. A handful of islands dot the waterways. Most agree that the Yukon proper starts at the northern end of Marsh Lake, south of the town of Whitehorse, 120 miles downriver from Bennett. From Whitehorse, the Great River twists and bends northwest for 1,000 miles across the Yukon Flats before reaching Fort Yukon. There, the river turns southwest for another 900 miles. At Mountain Village, the main Yukon frays into numerous channels, sprawling across the delta, before reaching Norton Sound. And it's this image that you give us, and then the next thing we understand is that this guy is going to launch a canoe from Lake Bennett with one other person with him and buy food in little stores along the way and essentially do the rapids with rope and guts and make it all the way out to the ocean.
Right. A little
undertaking for the afternoon, I guess.
A little undertaking. it was the original idea for the journey came from a fellow named Jess Sills, who was a filmmaker at the turn of the century, and he wanted Berg to film the caribou migration. Berg responded with, well, why don't we make it also film the Yukon voyage and make it a kind of a two birds with one stone. That's the way Berg thought. And then, of course, Sills came back at him and says, well, you know, when you get to the end of the Yukon, you need to go up the Alaskan coast on schooners and trawlers and film the reindeer roundup, I guess. That was a part I had to kind of study to find out what that was about, but apparently they had roundups and and herds were transferred from one place to an island. So Berg and his friend Fred Spokane Hill took off. Once they had finished a three-month journey, and then they were off on, up the Alaskan coast, and then they had to come back. So it was a total of I think close to 4,000 miles, and it was months that they were gone. It was quite amazing.
and the another amazing thing about this is some of these river voyages that Berg decided he was going to do. They were basically like barroom conversations, and the next day, wham, they're on the water.
Like I said, in the 1920s, he seemed to do one and turn around and do another one. His Columbia trip down the Columbia River, he started in the winter of 1924, and that was another mind-boggling start date. He's going up into the Canadian Rockies and starting a trip in the winter, which is kind of crazy. And he was not a kind of romantic, crazy guy. He was very methodical. He thought these things through. Anyways, he gets through with the trip in January, and in June he's off down the Snake River. And that's 1925. In 1926, he teams up with Fred Hill again, and they launch down from Skagway down the Inside Passage and follow the coastline all the way down. And apparently at the spur of the moment, decide that they should go back and run the Columbia. And so they take the train back up to the headwaters again and run the Columbia. So, you know, I don't know if they were barroom conversations because I'm pretty sure Amos was a teetotaler. But some of the fellows he hung out with, some of the merchant marines, they were not teetotalers.
So you've done a little river running yourself.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us a little about that career?
Yeah, I started in the mid 70s and in the Northwest here, and I ran for a company called Martin Linton's Grand Canyon Dories, and I started learning on the Snake River, which Amos had run, and the Grand Ronde and the Salmon and the Maine Salmon and the Middle Fork and. I have to say, I had somebody teaching me, so when I went to run these rivers, I had help, and I'm just always amazed that Amos somehow made it through. But eventually I found my way to the Grand Canyon. That's where I spent the majority of my career, is running the Grand Canyon. And that's where I first heard about Amos and his 1938 run down the Green and Colorado Rivers in an inflatable raft, when he was the first one to do that. So, that was my connection with Amos. And
well, I think one of the things that you did extremely well in the book is that at the end of each of the voyages where you actually have had some experience on the river, then in a different typeface and in your voice, mm-hmm. you kind of bring us up to date on the state of the river and reflect very for a few paragraphs on what the uh-huh. meaning of Berg's early voyage down the river, how that contrasts with the current situation, because a lot of these voyages that he made are completely impossible now.
They're difficult, if not impossible. And I was a little hesitant to do that, to bring my voice into the narrative. But as you said, I felt that by contrasting them, it would illuminate what Amos had done. I mean, it's just fascinating that he would go out there. And if you look at the cover of the book, the smile on his face is that is Amos Berg right there. He just experienced pure joy and was managed to sustain that throughout his life.
Well, the book is called The Last Voyager. It's subtitled Amos Berg and the Rivers of the West. Vince Welch is the author. Vince, you're going to be in town here to do some talks. You're coming next week, I guess.
Yeah, I'll be there Sunday at the. I'm not familiar with Juneau completely. There's a book fair or a book sale out at the mall.
Yeah, and you'll be in Heritage in the Heritage Book
yep.
Sales area, and that's
yep.
on.
Sunday.
On Sunday, and then you're also at the downtown library on November 14th at 6 p.m.
Yep, and I'm at the estate library at noon the same day.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
So you'll have a chance to see a little bit of Juneau again. I think you're.
Yep.
I think you've been here before, right?
I've been there before. I'm looking yep. forward to it, and I have a couple of semi friends that I'd made when I was doing my research up there a couple of years ago at the library, and I get to kind of hook up with Nancy Long again, who made this wonderful video called The Journey of Amos Berg, which K2 put out mm-hmm. In 1992, and I use it in some of my presentations, and it holds up really well. It's a wonderful, wonderful look at this longtime Juneau resident. I think all you folks up there should be proud and pleased.
Really fine. Well, we look forward to hosting you in Juneau. You'll be here November 14th at Hearthside Books, and also at the State Library and at the Downtown Library.
Yes, sir.
So come on down.
Okay, Pat.
We'll see you in a bit.
Okay, thanks.
Bye now.
He anchored the ark to a great big rock, there's one more river to cross. And then he began to load his stock, there's one more river to cross. Oh, there's one more river, and that's the River of Jordan. There's one more river, there's one more river to cross. The animals came one by one, there's one more river to cross. The elephant chewing a caraway bun, there's one more river to cross. The animals came two by two, there's one more river to cross. Crocodile and the kangaroo, there's one more river to cross. Oh, there's one more river, and that's the River of Jordan. There's one more river, there's one more river to cross. The animals came three by three, there's one more river to cross. The tall giraffe and the tiny flea, there's one more river to cross. The animals came four by four, there's one more river to cross. The hippos, they get stuck in the door, there's one more river to cross. Oh, there's one more river, that's the River of Jordan. There's one more river, there's one more river to cross. The animals came five by five, there's one more river to cross. The honeybee looking to build a hive, there's one more river to cross. The animals came six by six, there's one more river to cross. The monkey, he was up to his tricks. There's one.
About 7 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News, the music announcing the fact that we will have a visitor, Vince Welch, who will be at Hearthside Books and also at the State Historical Library and the Downtown Library on November 14th to sign his book and to give a talk about The Last Voyager, Amos Berg, and the Rivers of the West. My next guest here in the studio with me is Christina Butcher, and she's talking about a different aspect of travel. This one is the second annual GeoFest coming up from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Glacier Visitor Center, and that's on Saturday?
Yes, it's tomorrow.
Okay, hi, Christina.
Hello.
So what's a GeoFest?
GeoFest is basically a gathering for the community to come out and bring their kids and learn about geography and why Geography Awareness Week is very important, which is actually next week. So it's basically just to raise awareness and to help get our students geo-literate and to show them how the world works and how it's connected. This year's theme is actually Declare Your Interdependence, so it's about looking at how all the countries are connected and just bringing geography into education.
So your target for this is students of what ages?
Mostly elementary school.
Okay, so 6 to like 12
yeah.
age group? Okay.
Yeah.
And what kinds of activities will they be engaging in while you have them involved in the GeoFest?
There's actually a bunch of different activities set up at different tables that they can go around and do. There will be a geo quiz. There will be a couple of different Google Earth activities. There will be geocaching. There's also my personal favorite, which is Glaciers Then and Now, and it's a matching game that has pictures of a glacier and then another picture from the same spot about 50 years later, and the kids are always baffled by the fact that the ice is either gone or has retreated a lot, and they actually have a hard time matching it up because they're looking for the ice to be the same. So it's definitely just a big way to get the kids to realize that things are changing, and that's my personal favorite.
You realize now that the listeners are all cued in on this, so the kids will all defeat the game and you'll lose your prizes.
Yeah, that's okay. It's right. Good for the kids to do it.
Tell me about the geocaching event. Usually that's done outside and you're hiking from place to place with a GPS unit. How do you do it indoors?
Actually, I believe it will be set up outside.
Oh, okay.
That's going to be put on by the Department of Fish and Game here in Juneau.
Okay.
So the GeoFest is a culmination of a bunch of different people from around the city coming together and setting up different booths.
Okay, cool. And the event all takes place at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. There's lots of spaces around there for this thing to occur.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. How many people do you think you can handle?
As many as can come out.
Okay. And is there a fee?
No, it is completely free.
Completely free. And this starts at 1 o'clock at the Glacier Visitor Center. And is it set up in such a way that someone is there from 1 o'clock until 4, or do they come and go, or how does that work?
They can come and go. Everyone is welcome to come in whenever and leave whenever. There's a bunch of activities, so really it just depends on how much time you want to spend at each booth.
So if you can't get there right at 1 o'clock, you can still take advantage
of it. Oh, definitely, definitely. Okay. People are coming in throughout the entire event.
Outstanding. Christina Butcher, it's called the GeoFest. This is the second annual put together by the UA Geography Program and a whole bunch of community organizations, and Geography Awareness is Week. Awareness Week's motto is declare your interdependence. So it's all about the interdependence of countries in the world and our relationship with our geography and like that.
Yep.
1 to 4 at the Glacier Visitor Center. Folks, take advantage.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Yeah, guitar, that makes me move my hips. Play that kalimba. What's a kalimba? I don't know, look it up. On the banks of the Amazon, there's a blue whale swimming in the cold Arctic sea. There's a zebra running across the plains of Africa. There's a bird outside my window, and I hear it singing to me. It sings. I hear it singing to me. Yes, I do.
There are people I know, I see them every day. In my town, while I'm walking down my street. But for every friend that I know by name, there's a billion living things that I will never meet. It's a big, big world.
It is a big, big world, and a chance to look at some aspects of it Saturday, November 10th, tomorrow at 1 o'clock, between 1 and 4 at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center for the second annual GeoFest. Update to the weather forecast just came in. Tonight's mostly cloudy, lows around 27, east winds 5. Saturday, mostly cloudy, patchy fog in the afternoon, chance of rain and snow in the afternoon north of the Taku Inlet, highs around 36. Southeast winds 10 miles per hour, and then Saturday night, rain and snow in the evening, rain and snow late, snow accumulation up to an inch. Veterans Day, well, rain, highs around 40, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. You're in tune with KTOO News. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276AF. It broadcasts at 103.1 MHz. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269AO. That's at 101.7. Gustavus hears us at 88.1 MHz on K201 AM. K220BT serves Hoonah. That's at 91.9 MHz on the FM band. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on K210AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on JCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871, and our sister stations, KRNN and KXLL, are on 872 and 873. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Glad to be with you. Have a good day.